50 years ago, two best friends vanished from a quiet street in Hollywood, Florida. By morning, a canal held the truth. A white van, a road that hides its stops, evidence sealed by steady hands. Decades passed. DNA read the cloth. Two names surfaced. Both men already gone. Families faced an answer with no trial. This is justice named. We follow the record. We let the evidence speak. Sun pushed a thin bar of light across a quiet canal west of Hollywood. Water held still. Airboats waited on trailers. A family out to fish eased a pickup onto the shoulder of US 27, where the road met sawgrass and pale sand. The father climbed down first. Sand and shell gave under his boots. He looked past reeds and saw two shapes on the bank, close together, not moving. He called to his wife. He told his son to stay by the truck. He walked closer, stopped, and turned back. He told his wife they were calling the sheriff. The boy stayed in the cab with the window cracked. The engine went off. Heat made the air shimmer. One question hung over the water and the road. Who lay on the bank, and how long had they been there? The date was June 19, 1975. The place sat near the old Andytown Junction, where US 27 ran past canals and open water toward the interior. The day before, two girls left a home in Hollywood for a short walk to see a friend. Morning brought an answer no one wanted. A patrol unit rolled up from the east. A second car came in behind. A supervisor marked a line for tape. A deputy logged arrival time, took a breath, and kept the family behind the cruiser. Dispatch had pushed a possible deceased call near the water. The first deputy gave a mile marker and asked for another unit and a detective. The family who found the scene stayed and repeated the same simple account. The father had approached, seen enough to fear a crime, and stepped back. He had not touched the ground near the bodies. He had not touched clothing or debris. He kept his son away from the bank. Small choices at first light would shape the record for years. Early restraint protected what the scene still held. The canal edged the road with a low slope. The bank showed thin footmarks and a heavier press near the waterline where weight had gone down. Reeds leaned toward the canal. The sky ran white with heat. Mosquitoes worked through sleeves. Two small bodies lay side by side. Clothing remained. A scatter of small items sat within a few feet. Paper evidence sacks came out of a canvas bag. A camera clicked in a slow rhythm. The tech called out frame numbers and angles. Cones marked a path from shoulder to bank. None of the items looked like a purse or a school bag. Nothing showed a name. The ground spoke in a plain way. Someone had brought the girls to this spot and left in haste. Teams began to collect what the morning offered. Paper sacks, not plastic. Labels inked with time, location, and initials. Tweezers lifted fibers and fine hairs into smaller folds. The camera recorded clothing before any movement. A deputy logged the order of each step from the first cone to the final bag. Each label matched a frame and a line in notes. The work was slow under heat and bugs. The cadence stayed steady. Order was more important than speed. Custody started at the bank and moved with care. Each bag rose from ground to hand, then from hand to trunk, then into station intake. Each transfer had a name, a badge number, and a time in ink. Seals closed over the fold and carried a signature across the seam. The first signature was neat. The next showed a faster hand. A property clerk checked seals and logged shelf location. The vault air smelled like paper and solvent. Boxes went onto a row with other cases from that summer. Staff would change over decades. Ledger lines would not. Those lines would earn new weight half a century later. The father from the fishing family gave a written statement that matched what he told the deputy at the truck. He had searched for a spot to fish, looked down the bank, and seen two girls. He had stepped back and called. He did not move them. He did not touch clothing. He had no time estimate for when the girls were left. He recalled no cars pulled off within a mile before he stopped. He remembered a light breeze and a distant radio. His wife added one short detail. A white van had passed going north some minutes earlier. She had no plate. She had no clear look at the driver. The boy did not see the bodies. He remembered a bird tracing a line over the water and the sound of the deputy's radio. Detectives advanced in a slow grid. Eyes down. Hands gloved. One set a baseline along the edge of the road and pulled tape perpendicular toward the water. Another kept notes and spoke line numbers out loud for the camera. A third knelt by faint tire impressions near the shoulder. The shoulder carried traffic all day, so pattern marks were thin. Even so, he measured distances where the surface looked less churned. He traced a soft path from shoulder to bank. Grass bent but did not break. A faint heel mark near reeds took a plaster cast. The cast lacked detail, but they poured it anyway. The point was to secure what remained and accept limits set by light, heat, and time. Identification moved fast once word reached Hollywood. Two families had reported two girls missing the night before. The girls were best friends in eighth grade. A school day had ended with report cards. Summer felt close. Witnesses near the girls' last known path mentioned a white van on the street. Few homes held private cameras in 1975. Early interview notes would anchor memory when years began to blur edges. Families waited at the house. Phones rang and fell quiet. Units went to the home to keep parents from driving to the canal. By mid-morning, the sun stayed harsh. Photographers worked in turns to cut glare on film. A tech raised a small umbrella to shade the lens. Any movement of a body becomes part of the record. The team paused and spoke each step in order. A sheet went down. A stretcher came in. One detective marked exact hand and foot positions in notes. Another described a small abrasion on a knee and a dull smear on fabric that looked like road dust. The surface told a simple story. Signs pointed to transport in a vehicle, not a chase on foot through grass. No drag lines ran along the bank. The bodies had been placed and left. The final sweep found little beyond what they had already logged. Water hid what it wished to hide. The bank gave no obvious cartridge cases. No jewelry lay open on the sand. Wind pressed the reeds and then let them spring back. One detective made a slow scan from road edge to cones and back. He spoke the date and time aloud and closed his notebook. Units began to break down tape. A deputy walked the shoulder once more and looked for fresh trash or a dropped tool. Nothing new turned up. Seals created a simple line of proof. The people who signed those first seals worked inside a warm room with fans and metal shelves. None of them expected to meet a scientist who would read minute traces on the same cloth decades later. They treated the items like evidence with a long future. That care would pay off. Property kept a case number, a shelf code, and a log. Boxes sat in rows. Years later, a remodel moved the vault. A clerk noted the transfer on a form and initialed the seal checks. Another move occurred years after that. New initials landed on the same line. The box stayed intact. Seals stayed closed. Ink faded, but names were still clear enough to read. When a cold case detective pulled the box for review long after the first team left the job, the chain of custody held in black lines on white paper. Detectives traced the girls' last known path. They walked from the Hollywood home toward the friend's place. A woman on a porch remembered two girls laughing near a wooden bench. A teen recalled a white van idling by the curb. Times drifted, since heat pushed people indoors and then back out all afternoon. A grocer believed the girls passed the corner, but had no precise minute. A boy on a bike saw a wave from a van window and read it as friendly. He wished he had looked longer. He wished he had written a plate number in a pocket notebook. Early notes captured each small piece while details still felt close. Why this canal? Why this stretch? The road ran long with many banks where no one stopped. The recovery site sat roughly 4 miles north of Andydown. Traffic passed within view, yet reeds in a slight bend gave cover for a short stop. A driver who ran this highway often would know such pull-offs. A person who worked nights or drove between counties would know them in muscle memory. The place fit a quick transfer from vehicle to ground and a fast exit. Two families waited for names. Investigators worked lines in both directions at once. One line ran into the past, hour by hour from the last sighting in Hollywood toward sunset. Another line ran forward from first light at the canal into property rooms, labs, and notebooks. The day grew loud with generators, radios, and trucks on the road. A hush sat over the small space where the girls lay before the stretcher teams moved in. Heat built. Clouds stacked over the horizon. The scene was done, but the case had only begun. Back at the station, a sergeant called for canvas teams. Maps came out. Pushpins marked corners and storefronts near the last known path. A list of vans in nearby lots started on a yellow pad. Patrol units checked each van for plates and owners. Clerks pulled records on similar calls from the past month. Detectives wrote names and phone numbers in neat lines. Each page would sit in a folder for years. Each small entry made it possible to reach people later when memory softened. A second team checked bus stops and payphones. A third asked school staff for any conflicts or new friends. Nothing obvious surfaced. Nothing cleanly explained the jump from a neighborhood street to a canal bank near the edge of the interior. News traveled fast across summer air. Reporters called for comment. The office released only the bare facts during the first hours. Two young victims found near US 27. Identification pending. Families notified. Scene processing ongoing. Detectives asked for information about a white van seen in Hollywood during the late afternoon. The request went out to radio and television desks. Phones at the station lit as tips began to arrive. Many offers of help. Many hunches. Few with hard edges. A medical examiner's team took custody and moved the bodies with care. Documentation continued through each handoff. Timestamps marked release from the scene, arrival at the facility, and intake to secure storage. Clothing went into separate bags for later work. Each item received a line on a property sheet with a description simple enough to avoid confusion when years passed. Night reached the canal. A thin breeze moved across the water. A frog called and then fell quiet. By then the tape was gone and the shoulder looked like any other stretch of the road. An untrained, I would miss any sign of the morning's work. Inside the station, light still burned over desks. A detective read the day's notes from start to finish. A supervisor checked a list of tasks for the next day. Calls to the families would come at first light. The work would return to the bench in Hollywood where the girls had last been seen. It would also return to the bank near Andytown, where the first pages of the record began. Two families waited for proof and a path forward. The canal kept its own silence. The road kept moving. The case moved with it. Morning light filled a small house in Hollywood. Kitchen radio low, pencils and report cards on the table. Two girls in bright summer clothes sat side by side, reading marks and circling goals for next year. Laughter came easy. A parent poured juice and reminded them to be back before dinner. Heat pressed in through the screen door. The day felt wide open. By late morning, the girls drifted between rooms. One called a friend, no answer. Another checked a small purse for coins. Shoes by the door, hair pulled back, a quick look in the mirror. Plans formed in simple steps. Walk two blocks. Stop by a friend's porch. Talk about summer jobs and a beach day. Back home before sunset. School talk carried into early afternoon. A neighbor stepped onto a porch for mail and waved. The girls waved back. They moved toward a bench near the corner, a place where kids waited for rides or shared snacks from the store. Air held the smell of cut grass and car exhaust. A dog barked behind a fence. The day stayed plain and bright. Time inched past mid-afternoon. Store owners propped doors with wood wedges. An ice truck rattled over a pothole. The girls sat on the bench and swung heels over the curb. One folded the report card and tucked it into a pocket. They spoke about a song from the radio. They spoke about a teacher who pushed them to try harder in science. A small part of the day froze in those details. Witnesses would return to them for years. A white van rolled through the block more than once. Windows open. Music low. Faces barely visible from the street. People noticed the shape first. White paint. Boxy frame. Front grille with a nick on one side. Vans passed through suburbs all day in that era. Painters. Movers. Handymen. Few wrote plates. Few took notes. Memory hung on simple shapes and small marks. The girls rose from the bench and started toward a friend's street. A neighbor on a porch remembered quick steps and easy talk. The sun sat low enough to throw long shadows from poles and hedges. A boy on a bike rolled past and nodded hello. He remembered the purse strap over one shoulder, not both. He remembered a strand of hair stuck to one girl's cheek from sweat. He did not hear a car horn. He did not see a handshake or a stop. He kept pedaling. Another witness recalled the white van slowing near the corner. A forearm on the wheel. A motion like a wave from inside. No plate number fixed in mind. The van moved on. The girls kept walking. Or so it seemed in his memory. Time blurs when heat runs hard and days look the same. Early notes helped. Detectives would lean on those first lines when they returned to this block years later. By late afternoon, clouds stacked over the west. Air hung heavy and still. The girls turned down a side street with palms that threw deep shade across cracked sidewalks. A sprinkler clicked behind a hedge. Someone dragged a trash can down a driveway. A restless dog thumped a tail against a screen door. The world gave no warning. At home, A parent checked the clock, then the window. Dinner prep started. A lid clattered. A burner hissed. A call went out from the doorway for the girls to hurry back. No answer. A second call went to the friend's house. No answer there either. Worry arrived in small steps. First a glance at the street, then a walk to the corner, then a longer loop past the bench. Nothing. Early evening slid in. Sunset threw gold light across parked cars and mailboxes. Neighbors crossed lawns and stopped for short talk. A parent moved faster now, eyes wide, voice tight at the edges. The house phone rang two times with unhelpful callers. One neighbor said the girls had passed near the store at the end of the block. Another said they had seen two small shapes near the bench, then looked away to tend a child. Loose threads, soft times. No hard sight past the corner where shade swallows detail. A white van appeared again in more than one account, always with a small difference. One person remembered two people inside. Another swore only one. Someone thought a bumper sticker sat low on the left. Someone else said no sticker at all, just a rust fleck near the back door. These shifts fit how human recall works under heat and time. Early reports still held value. Several placed a white van on or near the route during the right hours. That alignment would matter later. As the sky went purple, a parent drove slow loops in a sedan, windows down, calling names at each block. A second parent stayed by the phone in case a call came through. Friends called friends. A teacher's number went down on a yellow notepad. A cousin checked a nearby park and the small bridge over the canal inside the neighborhood. Streetlights flicked on. Bugs swam in the light. Music floated from a house with a new stereo. The girls did not come down the street. The first official call went in after full dark. Voice steady at first, then thin. Two teens out on foot had not returned. Last seen near the corner bench. Short hair on one. Long hair pulled back on the other. Shirts light in color. Shorts and sneakers. No jacket. No known medical issues. No known plan to leave home for the night. The call taker ran through each field and kept the parent on long enough to clear follow-ups. Units drifted toward the area. A patrol car eased past the house and slowed. An officer stepped out and took a formal report. The officer walked the corner and checked the bench. A few gum wrappers near the curb. Foot scuffs in dust that meant little on a street with foot traffic all day. He spoke with the grocer. He spoke with the barber closing shop. He took down two names and a phone number on a small card. He ran the route to the friend's house and found no answer at the door. He drove two more blocks, then came back. The report grew by degrees and took shape in simple fields. Names. Ages. Clothing. Last known path. Time window for departure and expected return. Inside the house, a parent sat by the phone with a list of numbers. Paper curled at the edges under a small lamp. Voices on the line offered rides and small details. One friend had seen the girls near the bench. Another thought they had gone toward a different street to see a classmate. A cousin remembered talk about a new record at the store by the bus stop. The officer wrote each tip into the report and pressed for time stamps. Most replies came vague. Mid to late afternoon. Early evening. After dinner. Few people wore watches outside summer routines. Minutes get loose in heat and chores. A second patrol unit took a wider pass around the neighborhood. The officer checked the park again and rolled past a church lot. He paused by a white van parked under a tree and wrote down the plate. He tapped the body panel with two fingers and listened for a hollow sound that might hint at recent work. He looked in through the glass. Tools in the back. A paint roller tray on the floor. Nothing obvious. He logged the plate and moved on. Back at the house, the first officer asked for items to help identification if needed. A school photo. A piece of clothing with a recent scent for a possible dog track if a team became available. The parent stepped into a bedroom that now felt too quiet and took down a photo from a mirror frame. She set it on the table by the phone. She placed a shirt in a paper bag and folded the top. Small steps for a future option. Midnight brought a slow fall of silence over the blocks. Cars parked. Porch lights clicked off. The bench sat empty. Sprinklers came on in a sputter and swept arcs across grass. Inside the house, the parent's shoulders rose and fell in a steady rhythm between calls. A second parent stared at the clock. Neither wanted to sleep. Both knew sleep would not come. Officers wrapped the first pass with a promise to return at first light. The report would trigger morning steps. School staff would provide class lists and any notes about conflicts or new friends. Patrol would revisit the corner during commute hours. Detectives would join if morning brought no sign. A supervisor put a short note into the system to flag the case for early review. When dawn touched the street, birds woke and sang over the same routes the girls walked the afternoon before. A neighbor stepped out for a paper and paused. The bench looked like any bench. The corner looked like any corner. The absence felt louder than traffic. The parent by the phone stood and stretched tight shoulders. A cup rattled on the table. The day moved forward with steps none of the family wanted to take. Later accounts would frame the afternoon in small vignettes. A laugh at the bench. A flip of hair to clear sweat from a temple. A light run across a crosswalk as a light changed. A look toward a window when a radio played a favorite song. Simple things. Ordinary moments knit a path that stopped short of evening at home. The house held a dinner that went uneaten. The voice of a parent on the phone turned from firm to raw. Each hour widened the space between two girls and the life they knew. When investigators rebuilt the day in later years, they leaned on early notes more than late memory. A white van near the route. A sequence from house to bench to side street. No confirmed sighting passed a few blocks from the starting point. No store receipt. No bus token found in a pocket. No call placed from a payphone that matched their voices. The outline held even as details shifted. Two kids on a short walk in daylight. A route through familiar blocks. Heat and routine filled the gaps. Then nothing. Night closed over Hollywood two nights in a row. Friends who might have met them sat quiet at windows and watched streetlights burn. Parents kept phones close. Officers ran checks on vans that fit the loose description and looked for plates in nearby lots. No match stood out. The next morning would send help to a place where water touched land far from this kitchen table. Before that, the house held breath and waited for news. The day before placed the girls in motion with simple aims and an ordinary route. It set a last known window in a neighborhood where faces knew faces. It set a possible vehicle in view. It set a clock in motion that would run across five decades. The next day would anchor the case in a place that felt far from home, though the drive took less than an hour. The bridge from bench to canal would take years to cross on paper. The record would carry each step in neat lines and slow ink. Blue tape went up in a slow rectangle along the shoulder of US 27. Cones formed a narrow lane so trucks did not crowd the edge. A supervisor stood with a clipboard and drew the first rough map. He marked the road stripe, the waterline, the angle of reeds, the pull-off where the fishing family had parked. Heat lifted from asphalt in thin waves. Mosquitoes worked low over grass. A wind from the flats pushed the smell of water and sun-warmed mud across the bank. The perimeter grew in measured steps. One line along the road. One line from a mile marker down to the water. A third line closed the far side near a shallow cut where airboats sometimes launched. Deputies placed sawhorse barricades and kept bystanders behind the outer tape. The family who made the call sat in their truck. An officer stayed with them and took a second statement in a calm voice. The boy stared at a dragonfly on the window. The father looked at the reeds and not at the bank. A crime scene tech opened a canvas bag on the hood of a car and laid out tools in neat rows. Paper sacks, tweezers, folded envelopes, scales for reference in photos, a roll of numbered flags, a small umbrella for shade, a film camera with a spare body and lenses in foam slots, a gray card to set exposure, two fresh rolls of film in sealed canisters, a steel ruler with clear markings. He wrote each item onto a pre-printed checklist. He said each line out loud while a second tech matched the words with a nod. The first pass required a view before a hand moved anything. The camera clicked from road edge to water, left to right, high to low, long to close. The tech called frame numbers by habit, slow and steady, so the note taker could match each line. Horizon. Shoulder. Tire scuffs. Grass bend. Cones placed only after the wide shots finished. Close shots came next with a small scale card for size. A detective walked the bank with eyes down. His partner matched steps a pace behind. He used a carpenter's level as a sighting stick to fix height against reed tops. He spoke distances and angles for the map. The note taker drew lines and hash marks with a slow hand. They spoke as if in a library. Low voices. No extra words. Clothing lay where bodies had rested. Fabric held dust and a few small seeds from grass. A hair lay against a fold, pale in the angled light. A tech placed a ring of paper around it and set a flag for a close shot. He eased the hair into a small fold from clean paper and wrote a number on the edge with a fine pen. Another tech lifted a thread and flattened it between two glassine sheets. The number matched a frame and a line in notes. Order mattered more than speed. Heat pressed on necks and wrists. The rhythm did not change. A deputy held a long pole with a mirror to check near the waterline without stepping into soft mud. The mirror found a small scrap pressed into damp silt. The tech photographed from the bank first, then reached with forceps from a crouch on dry ground. He set the scrap on a clean card. It looked like a narrow piece from clothing stitching. He wrote a number. He did not guess in his notes. He named what he saw and where it sat. A cast of a faint heel mark from the prior day had set. It did not hold much edge, yet it showed a consistent shape near reeds where grass bent. The tech dated the cast and laid it flat on cardboard. He signed the cast label in ink. He did not scrape the mark for more. The surface would not give a better print. A poor cast was proof of conditions as much as of tread. The team drew a baseline along the road edge. From that line, they measured to each flag at 90 degrees and recorded numbers to the inch. A chalk line ran from cone 3 to cone 7. The chalk line showed a footpath shape where pressure had pushed pebbles into soil. Another line ran toward a flat spot near the water where weight had pressed down. The geometry looked clean on paper. In the reeds, the shape looked loose. Maps made the mess readable. Detectives scanned for cartridge cases and found none above the bank. A tech used a metal detector along the slope, though the odds were thin. The device hummed and ticked at bottle caps and foil. Each alert got a short test scrape, then a pass unless it mattered. Nothing linked to a weapon. Notes recorded each false lead, because absence is a kind of fact. Paper sacks took each item in the order of collection. A label named the location, the time, and the collector. A seal strip crossed the fold. The collector signed across the seam, so any later opening would break the line. The signature carried a badge number and a date. The first bag left the bank and went to a deputy who stood at a trunk. He checked the seal for smears or gaps. He wrote his own name on a line marked transfer. He placed the bag into a hard case inside the trunk. The case latched with a metal click. He logged the latch sound in his head. Later he would log a number to match. A medical examiner's team arrived in a boxy van that smelled faintly of disinfectant and rubber. A pathologist stepped out with an assistant and a stretcher. He spoke with the lead detective. They walked the scene together and agreed on the order of movement. The photographer took one more sweep of images before hands touched bodies. A white sheet went down next to each form. Gloves changed. Masks covered mouth and nose. Heat made breath loud in ears. Hands lifted with care. The pathologist noted position of hands and feet, tilt of shoulders, angles at the hip, head alignment. Short lines went into a small notebook. The photographer shot each step from two sides. When bodies moved onto sheets, the bank showed two silhouettes where weight had rested. Sand shifted and tried to level itself. An assistant pressed a rigid board under each sheet, so the lift kept shape. The stretcher wheels sank into soft spots and rattled on shell. The path to the van held firm once the team reached the shoulder. With bodies removed, the team photographed the ground again. A pale zone showed under a shoulder spot where sun had not hit the sand. Damp patches on reeds hinted at recent pressure. A tech laid paper against the reed stems and lifted a faint dust print where fabric had brushed. He folded the sheet and sealed it like a letter. A small debate rose and fell over a smear near the waterline. One thought it looked like oil. Another thought it looked like algae pressed by a shoe. They took a sample and wrote no guess. The lab would speak later if it had anything to say. A deputy walked the shoulder with a prism pole and called to a partner with a transit at the car hood. They fixed key points to a common reference so the map would scale. The sun climbed. Shadows shortened. A volunteer from the local fire station brought a cooler with water and paper cups. The team thanked him and kept moving. A strip from a paper towel tube worked as a collar, so loose grit did not blow onto fabric during the last photos. The tech set small sandbags at the edges to keep the collar steady. He placed scale cards along seams on the clothing. He tilted the camera to avoid glare. Each shot had a frame number, a scale tick, and a note to match. He then unfolded a clean paper sheet and used it as a tray. He rolled fabric from the edges inward so small debris stayed inside the roll. The roll slid into a paper sack. A seal closed over the fold. Ink marked the seam. A fine brush tickled grit into a small pile on a card. Tweezers moved the pile into a folded paper with a crease corner. The flap folded in tight to trap granules. A number went onto the fold. The card went into a small envelope that went into a larger one. Each layer got a mark. Each mark matched a list. A fisherman at a pull-off half a mile north walked down under escort. He had cast a line before sunrise and had seen no one near this point. He saw the same white van pass both ways in the hour after dawn. He did not know if it matched reports from the city. He gave a rough time and pointed to a tree stump he used as a mental clock. The deputy wrote his words in short lines. Another deputy checked the stump and made a note of shadow lengths. The times were rough. They still went into the book. A light helicopter from the sheriff's office ran a slow oval over the canal and the road. The pilot held a steady line and called out any fresh pull-offs or tire clusters. From the air, the bank looked like green lace stitched along a dark ribbon. A deputy on the ground noted the pilot's calls. A team walked to a dirt cut 200 yards north and found fresh truck marks. A palm frond lay crushed and shiny where tires had pressed and released. They measured the span between ruts. A pickup makes a range. A van makes another. The numbers went into the margin for later comparison. On the main site, the team pulled a fine mesh bag over the intake of a small shop vac designed for field use. The vac sipped sand from a square grid 2 feet by 2 feet around a spot where small fibers had lain. The mesh caught anything bigger than dust. They sealed the mesh in a plastic frame for later sieve work. The square left a faint clean patch on the bank. By midday, the trunk held a row of sealed sacks. The deputy closed the hard case and laid a numbered cable seal through the latch. He wrote the number on the transfer log and had the lead detective read it back. The case went into the second car, so evidence did not share space with general gear. Two deputies signed the chain sheet for that move. The car left for the station vault with lights off and speed steady. No siren, no rush. Calm and careful travel protects more than any sprint. At the station, the property clerk checked each seal, each signature, each time field. He spoke the number while writing it to avoid transposed digits. He placed clothing sacks on open wire shelving so air could move. He did not stack fabric sacks. He left space to avoid pressure points that break fibers. He logged the shelf code on the form and on a card taped to the box. He placed small glassine envelopes into a tray with dividers so they did not slide. He wrote a note for the serology bench to review for stains and secretor typing as an initial screen. He added a second note to hold back cutting until detectives set priorities. Cutting destroys edges. Edges matter if later work needs them. At the canal, the team ran a final sweep with a shoulder-to-shoulder line. Each walked a yard apart and looked down. A whistle blew at small fines, none of which tied cleanly to the case. Bottle cap. Pull tab. Cigarette but softened by water. A coil of monofilament snagged in reeds. All went into trash bags unless an item sat inside the mapped zone. If inside, it got a number even if it looked like trash. Records beat instinct in court. The heat grew blunt by mid-afternoon. The supervisor checked the list. Wide shots complete. Closed shots complete. Bodies transferred to the medical examiner. Ground below photographed after removal. Clothing sealed and logged. Trace collected from visible points. Cast made and labeled. Map drawn with fixed points and scale. Witness statements from discoverers and nearby anglers. Air pass completed. Secondary pull-off checked. Tire rut measured. Perimeter log signed by each person who crossed inner tape. He read the list once more and drew a box around the word complete. A last walkthrough took place with no equipment in hand. The lead detective scanned for anything out of place and for any tool left behind. Nothing looked wrong. Nothing remained from their own work. He took a breath and lowered his shoulders. He told the techs to break down. He told a deputy to release the outer lane so the road flowed again. The water made a small sound against mud. Reed tips rattled where a breeze touched them. Back at the medical examiner's office, clothing remained in sealed paper until a photographer shot each piece on a clean table with a scale. The pathologist dictated notes on external findings. He named visible injuries without speculation on motive or sequence. He noted fibers and debris and directed staff to preserve before any wash. He placed each item back into paper with fresh seals. He wrote notes on bag faces to match internal logs, so no one needed to open a bag to check contents. Each bag showed case number, item number, date, and initials across a seam. The voice recorder clicked off. A staffer rewound and checked sound on the first minute. The pathologist signed the intake sheet and looked at the clock. Evidence moved to the property vault from the lab with a second set of logs. The path from canal to property room to lab to property room again made a loop with the same rules at each hand. One person hands to one person, never a pile from table to table. Each handoff gets a line and a time. Those lines would sit quiet for decades until a cold case review opened the box and traced ink with a finger. At the canal, the tape came down. The rectangle that held the morning's work vanished to the eye. Cones stacked into a crate. Sawhorses loaded into a truck. A deputy stuck his head into the fishing family's window and thanked them for staying to help. The father nodded and kept his eyes steady. The boy looked at the road. The truck turned and eased south toward home. A brief came over the radio to watch for a white van with plain sides near US 27. Units took the message in stride. White vans ran up and down the highway for work crews and deliveries. Still, the note set a lens. A trooper near a rest stop wrote three plates in his book and sent them in. A deputy in a different sector stood by a pull-off and scanned each van for dents, stickers, or mismatched paint. Most looked ordinary. He wrote his notes anyway. Back at the station, the serology bench opened a tray for preliminary screens. A tech prepared swabs and a simple series of tests in a room that hummed with fans. He cut no fabric. He lifted only from exposed surfaces with sealed swabs. He wrote negative or positive in pencil on a grid, then inked the lines once a second tech confirmed. For fibers, he set small samples aside for a microscope check. He did not overhandle. He knew friction pulls threads loose. Threads do not grow back. Detectives and patrol returned to the city and worked the last known path near the bench. They did not carry the weight of the canal scene into those first doorstep talks. They kept voices level. They let people speak without interruption, then circled back to clear time windows. One woman spoke about a white van with a dent near the back. She placed it near late afternoon. She remembered a song from a radio at the same moment. The detective wrote the song title. He would use it to cross-check a likely hour with local disc jockey logs if he needed it. A boy on a bike added his line about a wave from an open window. No plate. He felt small under questions. The detective thanked him and kept the talk short. As evening formed over the canal, insects rose from the water in thin veils. A heron lifted and slid to a new pool farther down. The road took trucks and cars and a bus with a lone rider. The bank held a quiet no one wished to name. Behind that quiet sat paper, film, sand, fibers, and signatures. The map of the rectangle lay on a desk under a paperweight at the station. The film hung in a darkroom to dry. The cast of the heel print sat on a shelf with other imperfect shapes from other days when heat and sand and water had their say. The first day at the canal had given structure to shock. Lines on paper replaced guesswork. Bags replaced hand memory. Signatures replaced trust alone. From here, the file would grow page by page. Some pages would hold little more than a date and a negative finding. Some would carry turns that pulled fresh air into a room. For now, the road moved. The water lay flat. The rectangle was gone to the eye, yet it lived in the record. By night, the canal looked the same to anyone passing by. Inside the boxes and logs, the place remained fixed, ready for the next set of hands to read what the morning had left. Morning light reached two rooms in Hollywood and rested on posters, school photos, and summer plans sketched in pencil. Barbara Susan Schreiber, called Barbie by friends, kept neat stacks of notes and folded drawings in a small box. Belinda Darlene Zetterauer, known as Darlene, lined up pens, hair ties, and a radio with a clean dial. Both girls wore youth in a way a camera never fails to catch. Shoulders forward, eyes bright, quick smiles set without effort. Neighbors remembered easy greetings on sidewalks, short runs to catch a friend at the corner, and long talks over fence lines. The girls moved as a pair through school halls and along quiet streets near small stores and a shaded bench. A last report card day sat fresh in memory. Pens circled grades. Plans for next year formed in small jokes and serious vows to do better in one subject or two. A parent saved folded sheets in a drawer with birthdays and class photos. Inside school, names showed up on lists for homeroom and electives. A science teacher kept a notebook of lab partners and short comments. One entry paired the girls for a simple experiment with string and weights. Another entry praised neat handwriting and steady effort. Friends from class remembered light teasing, traded snacks, and voices that carried when a story hit a good beat. Nothing in those lines gave warning for a hard turn. Ordinary days make a strong record until a single day breaks the pattern. Summer in 1975 brought heat that pressed early and stayed late. Radios at open windows played soul, rock, and soft pop. Sidewalk chalk marks faded under sun. Bicycles leaned on porch rails. The girls moved through this season with the same small rituals every teen learns by heart. Hair pulled back in quick knots. Sneakers with scuffs at the toe. Pockets with coins for a drink at the store. A plan written in simple steps and shared without drama. See a friend. Walk home before dinner. Call later to laugh about nothing. Barbie had a voice that ran quick when she felt sure of an answer, then slowed while she checked a friend's face to see if a joke landed. She drew tiny flowers in the margins of notes. A small star sat next to any goal she feared she might miss. Darlene walked with a stride that matched music on the radio and kept time with a soft hum. She saved ticket stubs from a fair and a movie and tucked them near a mirror. The two built a rhythm that made sense to anyone who watched them move down a block together. At home, parents set rules with the care most homes know well. Call if plans change. Stay with your buddy. Watch the time near sundown. Doors stayed open to summer air. Fans cut the heat and carried street sounds inside. A pot clicked as water reached a boil. A screen door tapped once and settled. Someone laughed in the next yard. The day invited freedom and asked for simple care. A photograph taken earlier in the year showed Barbie in a blouse with a small collar and Darlene in a light shirt with a soft stripe. The print had faint creases from being handled often. Hair fell in clean lines. Both girls looked square into the lens with the calm ease of teens who believe in the near future. Photos like this live on fridge doors and in wallets, passed between friends with quick pride. In this case, prints would travel farther and endure longer than any family ever expected. The neighborhood itself carried the markers of a place built for family life. Low houses with trimmed yards, palms reaching past roofs, a school within walking distance for many. Small businesses at corners where owners knew first names and watched out for regulars. On most days, adults treated kids in pairs as part of the scenery. A wave, a reminder to drink water, a tip about a shortcut when a storm threatened. Care lived in habits and short lines, not in speeches. Teachers from that year later described each girl with a balance of effort and light. Barbie had a way of looking past a problem until a path opened. Darlene showed care for small details others might skip. Neither chased trouble. Neither drew the kind of attention officers note on weekly logs. They moved through a summer afternoon as millions of teens have done, with nothing more in mind than a talk on a porch and a walk home before dusk. Friends kept small items that held memory. A folded note with a joke. A keychain from a fair. A hair clip left by accident. People hold on to these simple objects for reasons that grow over time. In the days after the girls went missing, friends checked pockets and boxes for any clue they had ignored. They found keepsakes instead of leads. The keepsakes stayed and gathered weight year by year. One parent had a habit of lining up dinner plates early and setting a glass at each spot. On the day before everything changed, plates went out as usual. A call from the doorway went toward the street, then a second call 10 minutes later. A clock ticked on a wall above a small calendar with pencil marks. A path from kitchen to porch became a loop around the block. The loop grew longer on each pass. Inside rooms that had felt warm and busy since morning, silence took hold. In the first days after the canal scene, people spoke about the girls in living detail. A neighbor remembered a laugh that carried. A coach remembered a short sprint during a game of tag on the field behind school. A cousin remembered a summer playlist from the radio and a promise to learn all the words. These lines showed who the girls were in a way any stranger could understand. Youth full of small plans and daily practice. Friendship woven through ordinary hours. The shape of a best friendship showed up in shared routes, shared jokes, and a set of small protections. One watched the clock. One watched for a ride. One kept the purse strap in place during a quick run. One held a second key for a house in case a parent ran late. These habits build over months and make two kids feel safer on streets built for cars and adults. The habits worked until a day arrived when a pair of kids faced someone with an advantage no routine can match. The city held its breath during the first week. Adults spoke in low tones over fences. A clerk at a store set aside a notice board and wrote down tips called in by customers. A crossing guard stood at a corner with a face set hard against tears. Youth groups at two nearby churches offered rides for any kid who felt nervous. Strangers opened car doors less often for anyone, anywhere, and talked about vans with each other more than they had ever done before. The girls' names moved from everyday speech into a list on a bulletin board at the station. Each name gained a case number and a set of forms. Yet inside homes, names did not slide into paper and ink. They stayed spoken at dinner tables and on porches and in rooms where photos faced open windows. Parents kept rooms intact. Friends sat in those rooms and held small items that smelled like shampoo or soap. People spoke to voices no longer in the house. Quiet answers came in memory only. In later years, investigators met with families across kitchen tables and in interview rooms. They used plain words, answered questions with care, and avoided promises no one could keep. They knew a case file carries weight, but families carry more. Each meeting began with a simple line of respect for who the girls were, not only for how evidence moved. The best investigators learn this early or never learn it at all. Documents grew thick with notes that recorded what school staff remembered, where friends believed they had seen the pair, and which corners stood out as possible points of contact with a vehicle. None of this erased who the girls were in life. Paper can hold facts. Homes hold stories. The city held both. In public, memorials stayed small by design. A flower near a bench. A candle on a porch. Quiet hands guided these gestures, and no one sought a large crowd. People already had a crowd inside, built of memory and fear and hope. Over the years, a few anniversaries sparked short articles that reminded readers of two teens who never got to write adult chapters. Words on a page cannot fill silence, but they can show respect for lives cut short. A few classmates left Florida, grew older, raised kids of their own, and still kept those small keepsakes. A keychain lived at the back of a drawer in a town far away. A note with a joke rested inside a cookbook full of handwritten recipes. A school photo traveled across three states inside a wallet. Link by link, these small items connected people to two girls who had filled a summer with plans anyone would recognize. Inside official notes, a simple sentence described each girl by age, height, and clothing. Those lines serve a purpose in reports and press notices. Still, nothing in those lines can match the sound of a friend's laugh, the sight of two kids swinging their heels off a bench, or the feel of a warm radio on a bedroom dresser. Names deserve better than a set of measurements. This chapter reaches for that balance. Facts remain central. Humanity sits beside them. In the years that followed the press conference naming two suspects, people asked if late answers would help families heal. Some believed answers always help. Others said grief holds its own shape no matter what paper says. Both views make sense. What helps most, again and again, is simple recognition of who the victims were before a crime moved in and took over every headline and report. Barbie and Darlene lived as best friends in a South Florida city during a summer full of music, heat, and small plans. They trusted each other. They trusted familiar streets during daylight. They earned praise in class and learned new work in small steps. They looked toward next year with standard hopes. They spent energy on shared jokes and neat notes and plans for a short walk with a clear end. A record of life like this should not finish where it finished. Families and friends lived with that truth for decades. This case would move forward in later chapters with lab work, custody logs, witness reinterviews, and names pinned at a podium. Before all of that, a clear picture of two lives sits here, simple and honest. School, home, friendship, music on the radio, and a walk on a hot afternoon. No one should need more than that to earn safety. No one should need more than that to earn full care from a system built to protect kids and bring answers. By the time the series reached the press room in 2025, many in the city had grown old. A few never let go of early hopes for trial and sentence. Others accepted a different kind of closure built on proof without court. All shared this steady truth about the girls. They were known, loved, and seen. People said the names with care. People paused before they spoke. People kept faith with memory, even when paper took years to catch up. The story now returns to field work. Rumors moved through blocks. Tips arrived. Officers knocked on doors. The city gave what it could. The canvas began. By sunrise, the first wave of door knocks moved block by block through Hollywood. Two officers worked each side of a street. One asked questions. One wrote. They logged names, phone numbers, and short statements. They did not push for stories. They asked for times, directions, and makes of cars. They marked a map with pins that formed a loose arc from the girl's home to the bench and out toward side streets. At the corner store, the owner set down a ledger and walked through the late afternoon. He remembered a rush when the ice truck rattled past, and a quiet half hour after that. He could not place the girls inside his counter time. He offered to check the wastebasket for wrappers and cups from the right window. The officers thanked him and sifted the bin on a sheet of paper. Nothing linked cleanly to two teens on foot. A barber two doors down had closed late. He remembered a white van at the curb while he swept. He placed the time by a song on the radio and the light left in the sky. He thought he saw two figures in the passenger side window, but he could not swear to it. He gave a plate fragment he believed he saw. The officers wrote the letters and left with a plan to cross-check tag series used in the county. The bench by the corner gave no hard edges. Gum wrappers. A soda cap. Dust scuffed by 100 feet. Mothers stood in small groups and pointed to the side street the girls often took. Children watched the officers and fell quiet when they passed. A school bus stopped and breathed at the curb. The driver leaned out and offered her own line. She had seen a white van more than once on this route. She had no plate, but she remembered a dent low on the back door and a long scratch on the side. She placed the sighting during the last week, not the day in question. The details still mattered. The officers asked her to call if she saw the van again. By mid-morning, the phone at the station rang in bursts. Tips came from all over the city and from nearby towns that had seen the first notices. Many callers had heard secondhand talk. Some had walked the same blocks and wanted to help any way they could. A few told stories that reached past the neighborhood and deep into fear. The call takers kept voices level. They asked for one thing at a time. What did you see? Where were you standing? What time was it? What fixed that time in your memory? Patrol units worked US 27 and feeder roads. Troopers joined as they passed through sectors. Vans with plain sides became points of interest. Most carried contractors and painters. Officers wrote plate numbers and spoke with drivers. They asked where the men had been the afternoon before. They looked at hands and clothing for fresh paint or grease, and at cargo for tools that fit the trade on the door. They checked for dents and stickers and mismatched paint. Nothing stood out as more than coincidence. The girls' school opened a room for a briefing with staff. A detective stood at the front and set expectations. The aim was to build a clean timeline, not to chase every rumor. Staff offered class lists, locker numbers, and notes from the last week. They gave names of friends who walked the same path. They offered to call families who might not answer a police number on a weekday. The detective thanked them and said he would follow their lead on tone. Good information travels easier when fear does not carry it. Canvas teams returned to a small set of houses where residents had been out the prior evening. They found a woman who had returned from work just after dusk. She remembered two girls near the bench when she parked. She placed the sighting by the start of a game show on television. She believed the girls turned north toward a side street and then out of view behind a line of hedges. The time helped. The direction helped. The team logged both and marked the map. A boy who biked the block daily brought his father to the station. He felt nervous about talking. He remembered a wave from a van window and a voice that sounded friendly. He had not stopped. He had not looked long. The detective thanked him for showing up in person. He asked the boy to trace his route with a finger on a map. He asked what the air smelled like and what song he heard at the moment. The boy said cut grass and a chorus from the radio, the one everyone sang that summer. The detective wrote those small cues. Small cues anchor time. False sightings stacked up as the day went on. Someone thought they saw the girls at a mall across town. Another caller placed them in a park with friends, yet the names did not match the school lists. Officers checked two bus lines and ran into a wall. Drivers knew kids by faces, not names. Schedules shifted with heat and rain. No one could fix the pair on a ride. The rumor that they had planned to meet older teens vanished under the first hard calls to families and friends. No one had a single name to go with the claim. At midweek, the city held a small meeting in a school auditorium. Folding chairs filled. Parents asked about patrols, buses, and van checks. The detective at the microphone kept answers plain. He described the work at the canal and the steps since then without graphic detail. He asked anyone with a sighting from the route to call the number on the handout and to speak about time and direction first. He warned the room about guessing. Guessing feels like help and makes a file harder to read. He promised every caller would get a case number. He asked the room to look out for each other's kids while the case moved. Flyers went up on poles and in store windows. The paper smelled of solvent from a mimeograph machine at the school. Ink smudged fingers when it was fresh. The top line named two girls and gave ages, heights, and clothing from the day they left home. The bottom line carried a phone number and a plain request for any information with a time attached. Neighbors took stacks and fanned out. A clerk at the bus station taped one by the ticket window. A janitor at a church pinned one on a cork board by the doors. Detectives tracked a rumor about a man in a park who watched kids with a camera. Patrol found him near a pond with a long lens. He turned out to be a birder who photographed herons and hawks. He showed them a roll of film that held nothing but birds and branches and sky. He gave his name and address, and said he would answer any call from the office. They wrote it down and moved on. Work crews in white vans became part of a grid. A painting crew foreman stood by a lot and named each man who drove. He produced timesheets that placed his vans at a high school repaint job during the afternoon window. The crew boss at a moving company told a similar story and sent the officers to a loading dock that ran hot all day. A delivery service ran shifts on paper with notes about broken pallets and flat tires. Men at those jobs said they knew the look that had settled on the officers' faces. The look of a search that had not found shape yet. Most gave what they had without complaint. The phone log at the station picked up a run of calls about an older car with a primer patch on a fender. The car had been seen more than once near the bench. The tip sounded good at first. A patrol unit found a match and stopped the driver on a side street. He was a father waiting for his own kids to finish practice at the school down the block. He had fixed a fender with his brother in their driveway. He carried practice schedules in the glove box. He asked if he could help. They ran his license and sent him on. A man called with a story about two girls he had given a ride. He changed the time with each retelling. He changed streets and landmarks. He asked if there was a reward. The call taker kept him on the line and handed the phone to a detective who asked simple, verifiable questions. The man hung up. The call taker marked the tip false and moved to the next blinking light. As days passed, the canvas widened. Detectives stopped at payphones along the route and looked for coins stuck in the return slot and for numbers carved into the metal with keys. They wrote down the numbers and passed them to a clerk who knew which digits linked to which exchanges. They walked behind stores to check dumpsters for a purse or a book or a shoe that matched the clothing description. They found nothing that held. The rumor of a fight at school surfaced and sank. Teachers checked notes. Students shook their heads. Small quarrels come and go in hallways. None matched the tone or weight needed to shift two friends off their plan for a walk and a visit. Another rumor said a strange man had watched the girls at a bus stop the week before. The bus driver did not confirm it. A student could not fix the day. The noise of talk grew. The record stayed slow. The white van thread stayed alive because more than one person had seen a van on the route. Officers built a short list of vans with dents and scratches that matched parts of the accounts. Mechanics at two shops allowed a look at work orders for recent body repairs. A van with a dent in the right place belonged to a tile installer who had been on a site all afternoon with three men who vouched for him. Another van with a long scratch belonged to a sign shop. It had not left the lot that day. A few checks left open lines to revisit. None gave a clean hit. A small group of teenagers gathered on a porch and offered their own timeline. They walked after school like the girls did. They saw the same delivery trucks and the same men who swept out shops at the end of a shift. They warned each other to skip rides from anyone they did not know. They shared tricks for walking faster across the bits of street with less shade. Their view sharpened details on two corners and nothing more. Street knowledge helps with feel and flow. It does not always carry a plate number. A clerk at a gas station on a feeder road thought he saw a white van pull in around dusk. He remembered the driver as a man with dark hair and a watch with a big face. He could not fix the day. He kept a register tape from the week, but the tape showed no plate numbers and no clear method to tie a sale to a clock without a witness to attach to it. The detective left a card and asked the clerk to call if the van returned. The clerk said he would. The canvas reached a small strip of workshops where tradespeople kept tools and materials. Officers walked the aisles and asked about vans, drivers, and routes. They found one foreman who kept a handwritten list of where each van went at what hour. with a rough name for the customer in the margin. The paper told the story of work clicking along on a hot day. None of the entries pulled a van across the relevant blocks at the right time. Back inside the station, a sergeant called for a huddle. The room smelled like coffee and paper. He asked for clean summaries, not long speeches. Each team gave a route, a set of names, and 1 to 3 points worth holding for follow-up. The sergeant wrote them on a board under 3 headings. Time pins. Vehicles. People who saw both girls together pass the bench. The points were thin. They were not nothing. Detectives returned to the families. They read out what had been done and what was planned. They asked for permission to collect more items that might help dogs or lab work. They promised to call even when there was nothing new. They kept that promise. Calls that say no change matter. Silence feeds fear. Updates, even small ones, help days hold shape. Reporters pushed for narrative and motive. The office kept to process and fact. A short release said units had canvassed the route, logged vehicles, gathered statements, and requested that any sighting be anchored to a time and direction. The line about anchoring to time and direction appeared in each release. It was not a slogan. It was the thing that moves a case. Night after night, a patrol car coasted past the bench and the side street. The same car rolled past the gas station and the bus stop. The officer inside watched for the van with a dent low on the back door and a long scratch on the side. He found for that fit close and wrote plates. None came back to a driver with a record that matched the pattern people feared. He kept writing plates. He kept looking. A week marked itself on the calendar. Flyers on poles softened at the edges and flapped in wind. The ink stayed dark enough to read. A teacher freshened the tape and smoothed the corners. A neighbor replaced a faded sheet with a new one and wiped the glass with a cloth. The act was small. It kept the image present. Inside the file, the canvas chapter filled with dates, addresses, and short human lines. A woman waters plants every day at 5 and saw the girls once that week, not the day they left. A boy fixed the time of a van by the chorus of a summer song. A shop owner heard a car door shut at the right corner and could not say if it was a van or a sedan. Each detail made a tile. The picture did not yet show a face. The city did what cities do under pressure. People watched out for each other. Some stayed indoors more than they wanted. Some walked in groups. A few looked hard at every white van and felt their pulse jump. Officers kept routine visible. Routine is the frame in which new information stands out. The rumor about a connection to other crimes on remote roads began to rise inside talk. Detectives heard it and let it pass the room without taking root on the board. They planned a formal review of that topic when they had space to compare patterns. Not now. Not with facts so thin and fresh work left on the main line. A case grows wild if you water fear before proof. By the end of the second week, the canvas teams had returned to the same houses more than once. They asked if new details had come to mind in quiet moments. People told them about small changes in memory that never held when time and place were pressed. A few solid items did rise. A plate fragment took a new shape when a caller corrected a letter. A delivery route confirmed its trucks did not run the side street during the window. A bus rider brought in a pay stub that fixed his own time and gave the team a clean block to ignore. The list of vans to revisit stayed on a clipboard by the squad room door. The board of time pins held 3 marks the team trusted. The map with pushpins and string showed a neat walk from home to bench and a blank between that corner and the edge of the Everglades. The blank was the problem the file could not yet bend. When the sergeant closed the book for the night, he looked once at the board, then at the phone. The phone looked back like a piece of equipment that had not given enough yet. He turned off the light and left the door cracked for the next shift. Outside, the air held its heat. Inside, the file held its order. The city had spoken. It had given what it knew and much of what it feared. The record had absorbed both and kept the two apart. The next turn would come from a place quieter than rumor and louder than hope. It would come from paper, cloth, and a room that could read what the morning at the canal had saved.